One thing I did that's made me a better leader is we hired somebody on our team who's built a restaurant company to 100 units before. So like that was a huge, and again, big cost to me, right? But that was a huge advantage to me because also it's like all that infrastructure and systems that you have to put in place to be able to scale, they've already done. So they can bring a lot of that knowledge. And now instead of me having to come up with the systems and create the systems, it's more I'm learning about them and tweaking or saying like, yeah, I like that. That aligns with our culture and our values, or it doesn't. And we need to tweak that. Because just because they used it doesn't mean it's right for our business either.
Welcome to Franchise Empires, where aspiring entrepreneurs learn exactly what it takes to become a successful franchise owner, from one location to 10 and beyond. I'm the Wolf of Franchises.
Hey everyone, today in the show we have Lucas Mitchell. Lucas was one of my first guests back in season one of the podcast when he had recently acquired five Guys locations. Today, Lucas is at over 20 Five Guys units and is looking to expand even further. So we talk about everything from revisiting how he initially acquired the first Five Guys units and what it's been like scaling from 5 to 20. This is a great conversation, and Lucas is a super relatable person who I think for a lot of first-time buyers looking to get into franchising, he is a great example to follow. Hope you enjoy.
The Wolf of Franchises is the CEO of Wolfpack Franchising, as well as a creator at Workweek Media. All opinions expressed by The Wolf and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Wolfpack Franchising or Workweek. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. The Wolf, Workweek, and Wolfpack Franchising may maintain positions in the franchises discussed on this podcast.
So I sent you that tweet before we talked, man, that you and JT were going back on. And listeners of this show are familiar with JT, but JT was talking about how, you know, first-time franchisees might have to deal with buying a job. And you commented saying that you agreed with that because at the start, that's what it takes. However, you were doing, you know, 45,000 miles and 15 to 20 nights on the road a month. And when we last interviewed you, that's kind of the stage you're at. You were at five guys, you're at 20. You know, what has it kind of just been like, man, going through that scaling? And are you out of the woods of that kind of pain at this point?
Yeah. So it changes more so than like, I think I'm out of the woods. What I've really realized is, you know, the evolution of being a business owner, multiple locations, as your staff grows, the challenges become different. So in terms of like 45,000 miles on my car, you know, every week on an airplane kind of a deal, I would say, yeah, largely that part's over. We've grown a ton since then, but there's a lot of new challenges, right? Like learning how to, you know, manage employees and implement culture, you know, kind of down to the store level when you're more distant from it is a huge challenge that I'm constantly working on. You're solving bigger problems. You know, you're now looking at, instead of being so fixated on, you know, four wall costs of five restaurants, you're looking at how do we negotiate, you know, more contracts that kind of globally encompass all of our restaurants and reduce costs. And so you're maybe flying for meetings versus to the store, or maybe you're doing them on Zoom, whatever. But I think the challenges become different. And I think I'm kind of at a phase now where I don't know what the next challenges are. I just know that they're going to come. Like, I'm kind of like in a, okay, we've done the part of like hustle, grind, scale. Now I'm in this phase of like, okay, we're renegotiating a bunch of vendor contracts, trying to get, you know, benefits of scale, et cetera. And I know there's more coming down the road that I'm not seeing yet. And I'm kind of just looking at like, what are the next things? But I would say I definitely feel more like a business owner now and less like, you know, a district manager than I did when we last interviewed, for sure.
Yeah. It's funny too. I mean, most people would think, you know, five guys is still pretty impressive. So it's incredible, man. You've 4X that. And this was not even, maybe it's coming up on 2 years probably since that interview or close to it. But
yeah,
you know, when you're talking about these challenges, like negotiating vendor contracts and you know, kind of whatever else you're facing, do you get help with the scale you're at from corporate? Is there five guys corporate folks, you know, at the franchisor level, who are kind of walking you through from like the business side of things, of how you should be thinking about it? Or is it more you and maybe you lean on franchisees within the network to kind of make these decisions, you know, because if you're a first time owner, it can be just a lot to handle on your own.
Yeah, I think it's both. I definitely think like as we've scaled, I don't know the actual franchisee breakdown off the top of my head inside of Five Guys. But, you know, I'd say like we're not a small group anymore. We're not the largest group either, but we're large enough where there's more eyes on us, I think, a little bit. And also with that comes, you know, it's easier. Not that, you know, being smaller, you can't get kind of in the circles or whatever you want to call it with the right franchisees and people at the corporate level. You can definitely do that. I think it just gets a little bit easier with scale to get in some of those circles. You know, more people know who you are, whatever. In terms of like what I think a good franchisor does, and I think Five Guys has really recognized this through COVID and after COVID, and they've done a really good job of kind of adapting the support that they give to franchisees. And they, from being, you know, initially when I had five stores, it was very just like hands-on. They were helping you with four store wall operations, right? How do you make burgers, making perfect fries, helping you train your crew on all the operational pieces. As they've grown and their franchise base has grown and their franchisees have, you know, grown and gotten more sophisticated, they've also adapted to now where they still have that support. We're like, they have people come in that will help with those kind of things, but they also have, you know, a franchise business manager that will help kind of look at your business more holistically, as, you know, look at the financials, you know, help understand and see how you're comparing to other franchisees they might oversee and help you understand some of that better. That's one component of it. I don't necessarily rely on that. I think they do a good job, and I really think they care about our business from that perspective. But also, I think the best practice and the best information I get comes from connecting with other franchisees. You know, we've got Fast Act happening in California. And comments aside from that, I was on a call yesterday with a bunch of franchisees in California. We share similar geography, and we're kind of all talking about what we're doing in terms of how we're going to manage our staff going forward, pay rates, are we going to create ceilings, what we're doing with pricing. You know, we're all kind of collaborating together, and I think that's where the best practices really come from.
And you mentioned kind of your earlier days and how Five Guys has grown with you. But when you think back to just getting into Five Guys, and, you know, folks will know that you were on a previous episode of this podcast, and, you know, you talked about how you were, I think, like a web developer, and you got a job at Five Guys, mainly, I think, just to pay the bills. But getting into Five Guys, buying those first five locations, can you walk us through that process of what you did from raising the capital, reaching out to owners, and so on? You know, what was that like? And how did you do it? Because I know you didn't have the money yourself to just acquire five units of Five Guys, a major fast food franchise, all in one shot.
Yeah. So I think, you know, first thing I did was I leveraged relationships inside of Five Guys. I was already an operator for somebody else. We got great results. I think, you know, the people closest to other franchisees would be like, you know, the people on the corporate side all really respected me as an operator.
Meaning you were the GM.
Yeah, yeah. So I was overseeing, at that time, I was overseeing 10 locations in Nevada for another franchisee.
Yep.
And so, you know, essentially, like, started with those relationships, and I just made it known what my goals were. Like, hey, I want to do this on my own. I've always been entrepreneurial. I'm going to do it on my own. If you know anybody interested in exiting, like, would love to be connected with them. And just started there. You know, also started just calling different owners that I knew through, you know, our kind of in our region, in our demographic. And the first thing I did before I did anything with capital raising or whatever was I just tried to find a deal. And I found an owner in Arizona who had five stores they were willing to sell. And essentially my pitch to them was, I'll pay you a fair market rate if you'll work with me on the capital side, because I don't have the money. I just am pretty sure I can put it together. And that was really the conversation. Like, I'm not going to try to haggle and nickel and dime you. Like, I'm not going to overpay, but I'm also not going to try to get the best deal I can get. And we'll find a fair market rate and we'll work together if you'll work with me on the timing. And he was willing to do that. It took, you know, he was very patient. It took over a year after that initial conversation to actually execute a transaction. And then, you know, I started going to people I knew that were kind of in my circle through real estate investing, started pitching to other investors, ended up finding a partner who's now my father-in-law. That's a story for another day. But yeah, and together we kind of were able to put together the capital, got an SBA loan, and then that's how we got the first five. I initially went to him for feedback on my pitch because I was, you know, getting blasted out of rooms from real estate investors that I just don't think understood it. I went to him and, you know, it became something he was interested in potentially participating in. Also didn't want to put up all the capital and have all the capital. So then, you know, started making other phone calls and put together friends and family money essentially through our two networks and coupled it with an SBA loan. It was like one of the things I tell people that have had asked me, like, how'd you put together the money for the first five? It was like, don't think about the people you know. Think about the people that you know and who they know and who knows them. Like, think of your network as like three or four or five layers deep, as opposed, like, when I first started doing it, I just looked at my circle. I couldn't find anything. When I expanded the circle, that's when I started building the relationships with the people that actually had the money, but I didn't know them actually at the time either.
So you basically used your most inner core network, right? Where I think a lot of people are probably in that boat where they maybe look at their friends and family and they're like, well, they're not going to be able to help me out with this. But you start going layers deeper. And so you found a way to basically get to that fourth or fifth layer where the money was.
Yeah. The perfect example is, like, you know, my dad wasn't an investor, isn't an investor in my Five Guys business, didn't have the capital at the time to invest. But he also introduced me to other people that would. No, actually, none of them are investors currently either. But that was another layer, right? And then it's like, the question was always basically like, hey, do you know anyone who might be interested in this? You know, like, or do you know anybody who does invest in restaurants or something along those lines? You know, typically what I found is if it's not someone's asset class necessarily, they typically hang around other people that are investing their money. And so a lot of times you can find, you know, people that are interested in investing in what you're doing through other connections.
No, for sure. And I mean, just anecdotally, as the Wolf of Franchises brand has gotten bigger and bigger, I've just gotten more inbounds from, let's call it, like, wealthy individuals who want to diversify. They want exposure to brick and mortar businesses like a Five Guys. The thing is, they don't want to do the dirty work because they're at the other end of the spectrum where they're like, I did that dirty work, whatever that was, whatever business it was. They're kind of over that phase of their life and they have the, let's call it, the privilege of being able to just sit back and provide capital, but not necessarily give the sweat equity. But, you know, if you're someone younger listening to this and you know, you haven't earned that privilege yet, it's still a positive because that just means there's people willing to give you money if you can, you know, present well, find the right deal, all the things that Lucas has done. And, you know, it's a good opportunity ultimately. But Lucas, I want to talk about the actual deal. So, like, I mean, you know, you mentioned coupling the investment with an SBA loan. You know, how did you think about that? Especially, again, just, you know, your first time kind of going through something like this. Did you have a set amount of equity you wanted to raise versus the debt you were taking on? And even how did you know how much the SBA would even provide for something like this ahead of things?
You know, I had started talking to bankers. So before I had done anything in Five Guys, I was dabbling in real estate investing. Turned out I didn't like real estate investing, at least not as an active real estate investor at all. But, like, I had kind of learned some of the strategies they use about, you know, raising capital and how to use leverage. And so I had a general understanding. And, you know, I started just talking with banks, started talking with different banks and getting an understanding of, like, you know, how they could get deals done, what their underwriting criteria was. And I just kind of generally, you know, every bank's a little different, just kind of got a global perspective on it. And I didn't necessarily think I knew how much equity I had to raise. I think the first thought was, let's get a deal written on what it's going to cost the Five Guys. Then let's find a bank that's willing to do it. And let's figure out what the delta is, like what I need to bring in terms of equity. That's essentially how it happened. And then we were able to figure out, I think, I don't remember what the amount was. I think we ended up having to bring around $700,000 of equity with the operating capital included in that $700,000. Somewhere along those lines. And then that's how the rest was financed. I think it ended up being about, I think we ended up putting about 20% down on the first deal. And then, you know, we improved that, rolled it into the second deal, rolled it into the third deal, and we haven't had to raise any additional equity since then. So it's just kind of been, you know, improving operations, improving EBITDA, recapitalizing, using the capital out to acquire new units, coupled with seller financing. And so we've been able to grow without additional equity. So that, but our initial equity check was, you know, I think around $700,000.
All right. So you raised $700,000 and the rest to acquire that first five was the SBA loan.
Yep. And I think it was a $3 million purchase on the first five.
Oh, okay. All right. So you got, it was probably minority. Yeah. So minority equity then. Was that intentional? Like, did you ever get to a point where maybe you had investors who were saying, hey, don't do the SBA route, like give up more equity, but at least you don't have to, you know, do a personal guarantee and maybe all those things. Like, did you ever consider that path? And
so everything happened really fast. And I think like, I only had SBA debt for maybe, man, was it 2 years, maybe at most. And then we bought our second set of stores. We bought 8 stores in California. And at that juncture, we went conventional debt through a non-bank lender. And so our whole capital table changed at that point. So I don't think there was ever, to answer your question, like, no, I never really gave any thought to it. I've never been one to overthink things or necessarily worry about, you know, like maybe this is to a fault, but like, I've never really been one to worry about like where all the nickels and dimes lie at the end of the day. Like, I know what I want to make out of a deal that makes it a good deal for me. And I've always just kind of negotiated and done the capital structure based on that. And maybe I'm leaving money on the table, but I guess it never was really a thought to answer your question. It was just like, okay, this is how we can get the deal done. That works for me. Does it work for you? Cool. Let's go.
I mean, 700K and today you own 25 guys. And, you know, do you have debt covenants that you think, you know, are we talking like 5 to 8 years before you feel like you're out of that? Or is it potentially quicker, you know? I forget. I saw this on Twitter the other day. Someone was saying they have a name for like the day that you officially are free and clear of all your debt payments. But
I think I saw that. I think I saw that same tweet. I mean, I might get blasted on this episode for this, but like, we still have debt covenants. I'm still in growth mode, to be honest. Like, you know, I want to acquire more units. I want to continue to grow. You know, my wife and I have had a lot of conversations about the risk, and we both understand what we're doing. And I've never been one to be fearful of it or shy away from it. And, you know, maybe that's, you know, not the smartest thing on my point, but I try to be smart with leverage. Like, we definitely don't try to be over leveraged. We try to make sure we'll be well within covenant compliance, but it doesn't keep me up at night. You know, I think the premise of that tweet was like, you don't sleep good at night, essentially, like when you got all this hanging over your head. And it's like, I sleep great, to be honest.
I love
it. And I'm not saying that in like an egotistical way. It's just like, I don't overthink downsides. And I try to understand them and be smart about them, but I also just like, I'm focused on growth. And I know the way to get there for me has been, you know, through leveraging lenders' capital and doing it in a smart way. And I know I also have a lot of confidence that when I take over a group of restaurants, I'm going to be able to improve EBITDA. So I always know that I'm going in protecting that downside with like, if I'm underwriting, you know, conservatively, even less EBITDA than what the seller is currently running. Like, I know, especially in the Five Guys brand, you know, I might be more careful if I went and did a deal in Jersey Mike's or somewhere else. I might be more conservative with that there, but especially in Five Guys, like, I know exactly what I'm going to be able to get out of the units that we're acquiring.
Yeah.
And I'm almost always, you know, right there. So I think from that perspective, I try to underwrite that conservatively and I don't overthink it after that.
For sure. No. And I mean, first off, you're definitely not going to get blasted. The show is called Franchise Empire. So, you know, you're the perfect guest for it, man. That's what we're all about. And, you know, when you're talking about debt covenants, can you give a few specific examples? Because I think a lot of folks, like the first time franchisees, they just, you know, they hear, maybe they read about it on Twitter or somewhere about, oh, just get an SBA loan and, you know, you can own a business. But then they get into it and they're like, oh, wait, I have all these debt covenants. And there's actually, you know, they understand or start to understand and get overwhelmed by the real world implications of these things. So, you know, generally, what are you seeing? Like, is it minimum bank account balances of, you know, 50 or 100 or 200 grand or, you know, operating profits? You know, what kind of terms do you typically see out there in the Five Guys world?
Yeah, I think it's different depending on the lender. I will say, like, we looked at going SBA again recently and doing like a pari-passu deal with part conventional. A pari-passu is essentially like you have SBA debt And then you have a conventional loan alongside it that matches most of the terms of the SBA debt. You know, there's your SBA lenders would be better to tell you exactly what the rules are. But
sure,
we looked at doing that. And honestly, like whenever I look at SBA debt, the covenants are usually a little bit lighter than what I see in conventional debt. But the downside of that is, you know, typically they're also not only just wanting a personal guarantee, but if you have home equity, you're putting that up as collateral. And there's, you know, different types of red tape you have to work around. And I found that, you know, I can get better terms on debt in terms of like amortization time on the loan, things like that in the conventional world than I can in the SBA world. I would say in terms of covenants in the conventional world, right now we have a non-bank lender, so our covenants might be a little bit different. But essentially, you know, there's a pre-distribution ratio you have to hit and a post-distribution ratio you have to hit. So essentially, like your EBITDA has to be, you know, a certain percentage of whatever your debt service is before you distribute capital. And then you have to leave a little bit of capital in the business. You can't distribute all of it, is essentially what the lender is saying they want to say. And then there's usually a lease adjusted leverage covenant too, which is like, you know, what's your rent cost plus EBITDA, and then you divide it by your leverage. And I can't remember the exact calculation. I have a spreadsheet created that I do it all in now, but essentially, like, you know, that's got to be somewhere too. So there are covenants, but it's very easy to understand. Every bank also, I found, defines those covenants and those ratios slightly differently, but it's usually very easy to put into a spreadsheet and determine, you know, what exactly, how far underneath the covenants you're going to be and get comfortable with the ratios. But they're all cash flow metrics, right? They're just trying to maintain. And some banks, you know, some lenders, depending on how much leverage they're extending you and the terms of the deal, some of them will have minimum cash balances that you have to carry in the bank and others won't. I don't see that necessarily as common once you get larger scale, but it does depend on the lender, right? I mean, most of the time, like when you have a lot of restaurants, you're sitting on quite a bit of cash anyway, just because it's a capital intensive business. So you got to have it in there or you're not going to survive. But on smaller deals, if you're being aggressive with leverage, I've definitely seen that and been a part of them too.
No, for sure. So you're, you know, effectively at the point where you just know the Five Guys business so well, and you can kind of evaluate whatever these covenants are in the terms of any of these SBA or conventional loan providers. And you're probably pretty quickly able to just acclimate and know, yeah, this is something I can do for whatever the next deal looming may be.
I could look at a Five Guys deal probably now and I could estimate, you know, what the debt's going to be, what the equity's going to be on the back of a napkin pretty easily without a lot of thought in a Five Guys deal. You know, other brands, there's a lot more due diligence I'd have to do still to understand those metrics. But
for sure. And I mean, speaking of that, have you ever looked at like seriously getting into kind of maybe repeating what you've done with Five Guys with another brand? Or are you thinking for the foreseeable future of growth mode, it's just going to be more Five Guys deals?
I love the idea of other brands. You know, there's a couple specifically that have my attention and have for a while. I think it always, every time there's been an opportunity in another brand, it's kind of been in sync with a Five Guys deal. And since I know that so well, that's just kind of the direction I've gone. It's like, you know, I think if the right opportunity presents itself in another brand at the right time, 100% would be in on it. But it's hard to argue with, you know, I've been able to, essentially every 2 years, we've acquired a new set of restaurants and have had some pretty good growth over the last, you know, 5 years or whatever. And so I think it's hard to argue with just continuing to do that. You know, I think where I'll run into problems is there's only 1,600, you know, Five Guys units. And I think there's around 90 franchisees now or something like that.
That's it. So, oh, wow. That's a very healthy distribution.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, you know, Five Guys corporate owns, I don't remember how many units now, but at one point it was like 450. I think they might own like 600 locations now or something. And so there's only, you know, so much growth to happen. And like, you know, talk about rolling up smaller franchisee groups, right? There's only so many of those that exist now. And so I think like, unless there's, you know, an acquisition of a larger group or a merger or something with a larger group, I think it gets a little bit harder to scale in Five Guys at a certain point, as long as there's not like huge new unit growth. And so I think that's where like other brands are probably coming more into the picture now than they have historically. But I think I'm at that point now where it's like, okay, maybe we're not going to be able to do an acquisition every year or 2 years in five guys. Maybe we have to look at a different brand and start this similar path in another brand.
For sure. And, you know, you mentioned just looking at other brands looks attractive at times. And then you end up just doing Five Guys because it's what you know. And as you know, your experience kind of just shows that financially it's definitely working. How do you manage that as just an entrepreneur? I think it's so easy for people to have some early success and maybe things get like a little bit boring, so they chase something else. How have you just kind of kept your composure to be like, yes, okay, maybe these opportunities look like the grass is greener over there, but I'm just going to stick with boring old Five Guys. You know, I'm saying that facetiously, but
yeah.
How do you just mentally deal with the shiny object syndrome?
To be honest, I'd love to say it's just rigid discipline, but that's not me. I'm being completely honest. It's having good people and good advisors around you, good partners that are willing to say like, hey, is that the best use of our time and resources or your time and resources? You know, my wife's one of those. Business partners do it because I'm always open about what I'm doing. Like I try to just like what I'm thinking about, and I always try to just put it out there. I feel like you create opportunity for yourself when you share what your ambitions are, what your dreams are, let people know. And then people naturally kind of want to help you. And at the same time, I also have people in that are amping me up to go after those opportunities, like, you know, coaches and different things. And then I also have people that are like, hey, yeah, that could be great, but also, is it going to be a distraction? And also, I've dove into distraction before and realized the consequence that it can have if you put too much time into the wrong things, or, you know, you chase opportunity a little bit too hard, what it can do to what you already have. And, you know, at this point in my life, in my career, I'm chasing happiness and stability and a good life more than I'm chasing being a billionaire or, you know, worth $100 million. Like, I don't even know that I have a monetary figure on my list of goals at this point. It's more just like, I want to have stability, happiness, freedom. And so those, when you look at it through that lens and you've had experience trying other opportunities that have maybe caused stress, you know, challenges with family, whatever, then it's very easy to be like, man, like, yeah, it could be great. Also, it could really suck. And why mess with a good thing we have right now? So I think it's a combination, having good people in your corner, and then also just through learned experience.
Yeah. And I would, my only pushback is, do you keep at the Five Guys pace? I mean, who knows? You could be at a 9-figure valuation at some point, man, if you keep it up.
I mean, that'd be awesome. I'm not shy about wanting to make money either.
Yeah.
And like build an awesome business. I just don't know that like, I don't know that that's actually what brings the most happiness. And I think there's a balance there that has to happen. And, you know, the hardest time, probably a good story for the listeners, like the hardest time I've ever had in business was actually after we weren't at the scale we're at now. I had 13 locations, had the opportunity to run 4 restaurants, 5 guys that were close to us, and also run another concept for an investor. And I was all, you know, got great deal terms. Investor was really needed help. And I thought, man, this is going to be a huge win all the way around. Ended up taking way more of my time, causing way more stress. Weren't able to make the movements happen that I thought I was going to be able to because didn't have the team and the resources to do it. And so then my current restaurants like started suffering and struggling and paying the price. Oof. My family started paying the price. And I think I post on Twitter somewhere, like I got to the point where literally 11 p.m. every night was getting migraines and like fell asleep in the San Jose airport one day, like on the way back home to see my wife and kids, and with them splitting migraine, almost missed my flight. And I was just like, this doesn't work. Like,
oh my God,
it's not worth it. Changed a bunch of stuff right then, you know, like figured out how to hire somebody to do more of the operations, got out of deals that weren't serving us, refocused our energy on our core. And my life's been a lot better the last, you know, 12, 13 months since that happened. And so I think like that lesson in particular has really helped me evaluate, you know, a new concept. If I can acquire, you know, 6, 7, 8 units in a new concept as a starting point for the right price, I think I have the infrastructure and the management team now to do that and do it well. that's interesting. But, you know, trying to do a big turnaround deal or something like that, that's going to cause distraction from our what we do as at our core, which is, you know, find restaurants that are performing well, but not the best, and try to make them the best. Then I think, you know, if I get distracted from that and try to do something totally opposite of that, I end up in a bad place. So I've just learned that about myself, and it's easy to then shut off, you know, yeah, I've done this before. No, thanks. But pass on that one.
Yeah. You've made the mistake once and you're not going to do it again. So,
and as entrepreneurs, I think, you know, part of it is like, I would guess if you were to ask most entrepreneurs on your show that are at scale, they've all had similar and are able to maintain focus. I think we all think similarly, where it's like shiny object syndrome is real. That's what people talk about all the time. But I also think the people who have built something and understand that have also gone down the shiny object path before and have had similar results to what I've had. And I bet they'd all say the same thing. Like, it's always tempting and it's always willing to try, but once you try it and realize it's not, you know, maybe the upside you thought was there wasn't worth the downside risk, you reevaluate in the future.
Yeah, I think the key is, like, you really just have to be so rock solid in the current endeavor before you can jump to something else that requires more of your time. Because the hardest and worker and the most efficient worker in the world, you know, can't like run/start two businesses at once. It's just a lot of people make that mistake, it seems. And I've done similar shades of that, honestly, at times as well, where you have two full-time jobs and it's just, there's only so many hours in a day and you end up doing each one at 50% capacity, or one of them really gets a lot less love than it needs and problems arise.
Yeah, well, and it depends too. Like, you know, I think it also, there's always a cost to things, right? So like when I had my journey down that path, it was like, I was still trying to do it all myself. I was still operating my restaurants, had area managers, but I was still like, you know, I wasn't giving them the attention they needed to develop and grow because I was so focused on this other thing. And we've since, like, I don't operate the restaurants anymore as the day-to-day hands-on operator. Like, we filled that gap. But that came at a cost, right? It came at a real cost for me and being able to like have that person there. But now I'm better positioned to go and look at other opportunities, you know? And so I think there's always a cost to it too. You know, if you're going to start up a new business too, it's like, well, if you want someone who's going to have an ownership mentality, you're going to have to cut them in on the cap table, yep. Right? Like, and so it's going to come at a cost, but that doesn't mean you can't do multiple businesses at a time, but you need another partner that aligns with you. And, you know, maybe you become more of the money partner and less of the operating partner. Maybe you still retain control of the business, but, you know, at the end of the day, you need somebody who's vested and has a real interest in the outcome of that business that you really trust to do it if you want to do it. There's a right and a wrong way, I think. That's kind of where I'm at now, is evaluating, well, how do you do it the right way and make sure everything's successful, because you can't be the one to do it all. And that's been a real hard lesson to learn. I think there's been some other franchises on Twitter kind of having this conversation. And we've all gone through, you know, our own unique journey in terms of growth in that area, but we've all gone through it to some degree. And then now I'm kind of like sitting back being like, okay, I think there is a way to do this, but you have to be willing to give up something in order to do that. And where a lot of entrepreneurs, I think, get stuck is they don't want to give up anything. They want to have the next thing, but they don't want to give up, you know, a piece of the pie or whatever to make it happen.
And when it comes to Five Guys, you know, as you've continued to scale up units with, I know you went from 5 to 13 and you've gotten to 20-ish today. So, you know, how are you continuing to get these deals? Is it your relationships with the franchisor, or is it constantly reaching out to franchisees? You know, because this is a common question I get from people is, you know, there's some people who different risk tolerances, they don't want to go into an emerging brand. They're like, hey, if I'm buying a franchise, I want a brand that's nationally known and that I don't have to worry about foot traffic for, because everyone in the country already knows what this company is. But their big thing is, how the hell do I get in front of someone who can actually help me break in? So, you know, what are you seeing? Is it the franchisor helping you at this stage? And, or is it, again, more of the franchisees that you're just individually saying, hey, like, I'm here to go, you know, not, you know, politely gobble you up once you're ready to retire or sell?
It's both. If you're already in the brand, being the best operator, like, again, everybody inside of the brand, I mean, at least in Five Guys, I don't know how they compensate all of their people. No idea. Not going to speak for them. But I do know that they're, I feel like everybody that knows all the franchisees and works with the franchisees is incentivized to have the best franchisees and the best operators in their territories, right? And so like being the best operator obviously gives you an advantage. If somebody hears somebody wants to sell, you're going to be the first phone call they make because they'd rather have a good operator acquired than somebody they don't know. I think that's kind of like the way it works with the franchisor. But I think more of it is just relationships. Like the most recent deal we acquired was we acquired in July of 23. And we had, like, I had talked at a conference with this seller at the Five Guys conference. I don't know. Had to have been, let's see, every probably two years before that, I guess. Would have been like 2020, maybe. Almost 3 years before. It would have been after COVID. I don't remember. Anyways, it was a year or two before we actually started the transaction. And the bug was just kind of put in his ear like, hey, you know, if you're ever looking to sell, we're your neighbors, like, would love to talk about it. And then follow-up email, you know, year and a half later, I kind of heard through the grapevine, maybe they were entertaining the opportunity, and hit him with an email. Hey, remember we talked about this conference, like, if you would love to talk about it. And that's where it started. So that's just relationship with franchisees, you know, being involved in committees, which is something I'm getting into a lot now, which I've never done before. But getting involved with the franchisee committees and meeting other franchisees, I think is the best way because you never know when somebody's ready. But I think everybody's always willing to make the phone call to their neighbors first and just let them know, hey, we're entertaining this. Do you want to try to make something work here? You know, most of the business owners too would rather have somebody they know, like, you know, every franchisee that's around me can see my numbers and see my performance. They'd rather call me and have a discussion about selling their business that they've built over the last, you know, decade or however long they've built it to somebody they know is going to take care of it than they would just, you know, throw it on the market in a lot of cases. So, but then also just relationship with brokers. You know, our deal before that came, it was a public deal, but I would say it was public-private and that it was listed with an investment bank, but it wasn't publicly listed anyway. So they were like doing cold outreach to people in the restaurant space, starting within the brand on behalf of the seller. So, you know, same thing, building those relationships is really key too.
It's always interesting to me that that happens, like brokers and sometimes bankers come involved. Is that from, you know, versus just running through entirely to the franchisor? Is that really from the franchisee side saying, hey, like, I want to maximize the value of this transaction?
I think so that's where it is. Yeah. And then there's like a hybrid too, right? Like going and publicly listing a deal with a large brokerage house that's going to blast it all over the internet and get a million eyes on it might get you the most offers. But, you know, also there's a likelihood, you know, your key team members are going to find out before you're ready to tell them, you know, or whatever. There's risk. And then there's the kind of like a hybrid approach where you list it with the brokerage, but they're not going to publicly list it on internet websites or whatever, but they're willing to get their hands dirty. And, you know, they have a network of, you know, restaurant operators and franchisees that they're going to call or blast an email out to, but it still kind of stays a little closer to the vest, you know, so not anyone can access the information and you can still get a good evaluation. So I think that's kind of how it happens is, you know, trying to maximize the value. And I think it depends on scale too, right? Getting enough eyeballs on, this is just my opinion, you know, business brokers could tell me I'm very wrong, but trying to get enough eyeballs on a 5-unit deal, maybe the best way is a big national brokerage house because, you know, that the level, like the entry level is a little lower. Like, you know, maybe, you know, somebody looking on biz buy sell is going to find that business and be able to actually execute on the transaction. Versus when you get to, you know, 8-9 figure deals, you know, largely you're looking for one, the franchisor is not going to allow just anyone off the streets to buy that deal. So you're looking at a, you know, you kind of have your target groups, large restaurant operators, private equity, family office. And so I think you're a little bit more limited in the pool of buyers. And so maybe that's where you go an investment bank route. You could still maximize the sale value, but it's not super public. But also it's like, you know, you're definitely not going to maximize your value if you just call your neighbor franchisee, at least I don't think, you know, like, but there's other motivations there to sell to your neighbor, right? That's not necessarily monetary.
Absolutely. No, I mean, there's pros and cons to weigh with that. And it's just funny. There's so much talk about starting businesses, running them, but the exit is often under discussed, but maybe that's an episode for another day. for me with someone. Maybe I'll bring in a business broker. You know, before we kind of, I know we're coming out of time here, but before we jump off, what has it, you know, like almost tactically at a ground level been like for you to really level up your management? Because as you said, like you've gone from 5 to 13 to, you know, 20 plus stores. So, and you mentioned how you weren't giving employees enough time. And I know you have advisors, but how have you actually leveled up as a leader to be able to do things that I would imagine you're doing, like goal setting, keeping people motivated, figuring out how to like work in almost, I would guess, some type of performance-based comp for your key team members? You know, how do you, because you don't just learn that overnight. So are you just kind of like going by your gut and trying to treat people kind of the way that you would hope to be treated as an employee? Or, you know, do you have some operating system or some business coach where you have some serious guidelines for how you're running this business? You know, what's that been like?
I don't say I have like some serious guidelines. We're getting more structured in how we, you know, compensate employees, whatever. Whereas at a smaller scale, it's a little easier to just kind of like, you know, do it based on employee and performance and whatever else. Yeah. And like, that gets a little more nuanced at a larger scale. I think one thing I did that's made me a better leader is we hired somebody on our team who's built a restaurant company to 100 units before. So like that was a huge, and again, big cost to me, right? But that was a huge advantage to me, because also it's like all that infrastructure and systems that you have to put in place to be able to scale, they've already done. So they can bring a lot of that knowledge. And now instead of me having to come up with the systems and create the systems, it's more I'm learning about them and tweaking or saying like, yeah, I like that. That aligns with our culture and our values, or it doesn't. And we need to tweak that. Because just because they used it doesn't mean it's right for our business either. Right. But I'm more like playing that role of hearing what we're doing and deciding if it's a good fit and it aligns with the vision and the culture that we've established in our company and where we're going, as opposed to having to create it. And so I think that was one huge advantage. I think that's like the shortcut for entrepreneurs that really want to grow, is find somebody who's done it before and figure out how to work with them in one way or another. You know, that could be a free internship in a lot of cases. You know, that could also be a partnership. It could also be hiring somebody if you already have your own business that, you know, is an amazing employee and doesn't have the risk tolerance for ownership, but they've done what it is you're trying to do. Because operating the restaurants isn't business ownership. That's an operator, right? That's like a COO integrator type role. And so, you know, there are plenty of employees out there who are really good at that too, that you could hire. You know, then just reading books. I do have a business coach. I mean, I've had various coaches for different things in my life. Continue to coach people, learning from other franchisees, understanding what's worked for them, what's failed. And then I think, you know, part of it is just leaning on why we started doing this. I was a restaurant employee. I worked for bad operators. I knew there was a way we could make plenty of money and put our people first at the same time. And so we've kind of leaned on that. You know, our VP of ops now has that same mentality, and he'll tell other people like, you know, Lucas is an employee first owner. And so we always lean on that when we're making decisions. Like, we have to manage the business well, but we also weigh it against what's going to take care of our people always. And that's been huge. And then I think, you know, you just learn and evolve as you fail, and you got to be open to criticism, and you got to be open to owning your shortcomings and your faults and learning from them. And then you just kind of develop the leadership skills as you go.
For sure. You know, watching you evolve from afar has been fun, man. And hoping you continue to crush it. So, and I'm confident you will. Yeah, man, this has been awesome to catch up and kind of get an update on this next leg of your journey. So yeah, just want to ask where, if people want to follow your journey from 20 to 100 or whatever's next, is there a good spot online where they can do that?
I mean, Twitter. I don't post a ton on Twitter, but I'm always in the comment threads. I don't know. You know, I'm not snarky.
Comment warrior.
I don't know if that makes me. Yeah, comment warrior. I like that better than reply guy. I guess that's the word. Yeah. I'm really snarky, right? If I'm a reply guy. yes. But yeah, I'm a comment warrior on Twitter. I do want to start posting more on Twitter. So I do have a goal this year to put more content out on Twitter. L Mitchell HQ is the handle.
Yeah, you know, it's tough to be doing all the content, man, when you're out there making deals. So don't feel bad about it.
Well, and I've always been one of those where it's like, I don't want to like have it ghost written or like,
yeah, AI.
Like it's not the same. Like I want it to be really from me with like all my typos and poor grammar and all that good stuff that comes along with me being myself.
Yes. That's how we know a human's behind it.
Yeah.
Amazing. All right. Well, we'll plug Lucas's Twitter handle in the show notes. And yeah, man, we'll catch you on the next leg of your journey. So thanks again, man. And we'll talk soon.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Franchise Empires. We're coming to you soon with actionable insights to take the next step on your franchise journey. So make sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen.